Happy April to all of our AZMcast listeners. I am very happy to say that both Jared and I have had our respective babies, and we are now headed into reclusive daddy mode. But no worries, we have plenty of AZMcast goodness stored up for you guys. I have to warn you, though, that we pre-recorded these segments, so they may be a little bit dated. First, we're going to talk about some wonder drugs that are coming out. Zygris, we've got, no. All right, let's go to Plan B. This month we're talking about neurology, toxicology, and psychiatry, and that ugly part of the Venn diagram where they all meet called the emergency department. We'll discuss the evaluation of basically the weird patient and how to approach their weirdness with the help of our toxicology team, Dr. Robert French and Dr. Nicholas Hurst. Next, we'll talk with Dr. Al Fiorello about documentation of your neuro exam. This was a special request from one of our residents that took a long time to get. I'm so sorry it took such a long time to get, but I promise it will be worth it. Al has some great tips not only for the documentation, but actually for the implementation of your exam so that you can get a rapid-fire neuro exam to help get you moving. Finally, we haven't heard from Dr. Rosen in a while, so we'll ask him about the rare procedures of emergency medicine that we're supposed to be able to do that maybe we've never actually done in residency, that maybe as you're getting near the end of your senior year, you won't get a chance to do in residency. What do you do about that? He's got some great thoughts that helped me out because there's still several I haven't done. And with that, let's get to the pre-recorded goodness that is April's AZMcast.
Surprisingly enough, not at all related to toxicology. No, it's completely related to toxicology. So we're going to talk about a case that I had recently. So I had this case with Judson, and this is an 18-year-old female that was brought in by EMS for altered mental status and posturing. So right off the bat, I'm thinking something's wrong with her brain. If she's posturing, she's herniating as a head bleed, something like that. But when she came in, she looked really interesting. She's lying there on the bed with her tongue protruded out, kind of rhythmically protruding her tongue out, and her right arm is up in the air, kind of like rhythmically moving back and forth, like from the old Arsenio Hall show. It's exactly what she looked like. And we kind of take a look at her, and we have no idea what we're looking at. She's altered mental status. She's got a little bit of an abrasion on her forehead, but not a whole lot else, and there's no one else to give a history. So asking you guys that are our toxicology specialists, the three things I'm thinking of is she neuro, is she tox, or is she psych? And Judson appropriately added, is she trauma, because they found her on the side of the road. So he slips a C-collar on her, and we're getting ready to send her to scanner. But before EMS leaves, and Robert, you've done EMS stuff as well, what are some things that we should ask EMS to try to get any history whatsoever before they leave?
Well, you know, certainly EMS can bring a lot of information to the table that once they leave becomes very difficult to get. So, you know, what was the setting in which they found her? Was she at home? Was she on the street? Was she at a club? Was she under a bridge? What was around her? You know, were there paraphernalia or drugs or alcohol? But, you know, that piece, the set and setting from where she was found, you may only have a limited amount of time to get that information.
Yeah, so we asked him real quick, the big thing that we always forget, we asked him the finger stick. And they said her finger stick was 117, and they said they found her on the side of the road, didn't know what else was going on, thought maybe she was seizing, so they went ahead and gave her some Versed. From a toxicology standpoint, can you ever go wrong with some benzos?
Oh, well, you can always go wrong if you can. but we know what benzos do. They're safe. They, you know, we know what to expect if folks get too much. So, you know, it's a reasonable start.
I was always told that benzos were God's gift to toxicology. So we start to examine the patient. We do our typical exam. The things that stick out to you is that she's got her eyes open. She's not really tracking anybody. She's got her tongue sticking out and protruding in this weird rhythmic motion that goes along with just the right arm that's moving back and forth. The rest of her exam really didn't yield much. But from a, again, from a toxicology perspective, what are some of the things that you do as the tox team or as the initial ER doc that you say, I'm going hunting for toxidromes? What are you looking for specifically on a patient to see if they're tox?
Well, I think one of the big things is, you know, pupils. As you already mentioned, I think her pupils were large. And, you know, right away, that's something that can help you narrow down or, you know, help you think of different things. If they're really small, everyone, you know, thinks of an opioid toxidrome. And then certainly if they're very large, we might think more anticholinergic. So that's one for sure not to miss. Going on from there, you know, some of the things we look for are clonus, that kind of rhythmic beating of the feet in particular. We usually do hyperreflexia or hyporeflexia are also two big ones. Checking their skin, are they dry, are they sweaty, and also looking for muscle rigidity are also things we do on every patient. You know, looking for the, you know, lower more than upper, upper more than lower, the lead pipe rigidity, or, you know, lift them up just above the knee, and if their heel drags along the bed, they're probably not rigid, just to kind of cover a lot of the more common toxidromes that we see.
If there's, you know, in these situations where there's not a whole lot of information, you know, where do you start? And the best place to start is with the patient, you know, in your physical exam. And as Nick said, does the picture you see fit a toxidrome? Do they appear sympathomimetic? Do they appear anticholinergic? Do they appear serotonergic? Do they appear opiate? And then, you know, where I think where the tox training, for what it's worth, comes in is knowing the exceptions to those rules. Okay, not every opiate causes small pupils. Not every anticholinergic medication causes big pupils. You know, some of the atypical antipsychotics, someone can have anticholinergic delirium, but their pupils may actually be small. So, you know, examining the patient, seeing if they fit a toxidrome, using all available means to try and get a bit of history, whether it's EMS, whether it's, you know, calling the major pharmacy chains to see if the patient has a medication history with those pharmacies. You know, certainly if you call us, we'll sic one of the pharmacy students on calling the major chains to see if there's a history there. Social services can help you out to see if the patient is known to the social service agencies that provide mental health services. And from there, we may be able to get a medication list or a bit of a medication history.
Yeah, I mean, limited history is often what we see, but I think, as with, you know, everything else in medicine, history is key. And, you know, even if we can't get it directly from the patient, you know, call the family members, find out, well, what else is in the house? You know, who else at home is on medications and what are those medications? Trying to figure out what may they have gotten into, what do they have access to, are huge.
So funny you should say that about the family. So we sent her off to CT after putting the aspirin on. CT head and C-spine were negative. And after we sent her, mom showed up. Mom spoke very limited English. She spoke a language that not anybody in the department would speak. So got on a translator phone. Her English was kind of broken. And asked her about some of her medications. And she wasn't able to list them, but she knew that she just got a whole bunch of new medications. So we said, we kind of did a little bit of a risky thing, is we took our only historian and said, go home, bring them all back. So she goes, well, after she's back, we go now. We need this info right now. Her airway was okay. We didn't feel we needed to manage it yet. This is a great Dr. Walterism. But we took a little saline down the nose and saw if she swallowed it, which she did just fine. And interestingly enough, when we sternal rubbed the patient, she stopped her, or she took her left hand that wasn't doing the Arsenio Hall and grabbed at my fist. And then when I rubbed a little bit further, she grabbed with the other hand, had both hands on my fist, and then looked over and localized me as if to say, stop doing that, jerk. So that made me feel a little bit better that she was somewhat responsive, but we still didn't have a clue what was going on. So now mom left. I sent my historian away, and the patient's back, and the nurses want to know, what kind of labs do you want? So what are your shotgun labs for an undifferentiated tox patient?
With what you're telling me thus far, I'd certainly want, you know, basic chemistries and a total CK.
So sometimes I've had some attendings when I was a resident, they'd say, well, just order all the levels. Get a digoxin level, get a lithium level, get a phenytoin level, get a Depakote level, get any level that you can possibly get, and we'll sort it out later. What are your thoughts on that kind of approach? I mean, I'm sure that you'll catch some things that way, but is it going to throw you off if you get a false positive? Or what's kind of, when do you pull the trigger on ordering those levels?
Well, I like to get a little bit of medication history before ordering too many levels, or at least, you know, if somebody has a history of bipolar disorder and they have undifferentiated altered mental status, then I'd probably be more tempted to get levels of the common mood stabilizers, sulfapyroic acid, lithium, of course, and carbamazepine.
I feel like it's not that way with acetaminophen and salicylates, though. We just order those freely on everybody.
Yeah, well, yeah. See, and the reason there is they're very treatable, and if you miss them, it's very problematic. Most of the others, if you do some good supportive care, the patient's going to do fine. But if you overlook an acetaminophen, you know, they can die of fulminant hepatic failure. And then certainly aspirin can be problematic if it's missed or mismanaged.
And they're both very accessible, and in so many other products, I think it's, you know, something, it behooves you to check for it, because you can do something about it, and just the likelihood that they would get into those is pretty high. So,
EKG for any altered patient looking for tox stuff, you guys agree?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Very low risk, very high benefit if you find something, right?
Quick.
All right. What about a U-tox? Are they helpful for you? Or are they just kind of a, well, most of the stuff's not going to show up?
Well, I think, you know, using urine tox screen, at least knowing what you're looking for or what you're trying to exclude, but with an understanding of the limitations, okay? Your opiates is certainly going to pick up your heroin. It's going to pick up codeine. It's going to pick up morphine. The semi-synthetics, it's more variable, and it's not going to pick up methadone or fentanyl. So as long as you know that going in, it's, you know, reasonable. Benzos, knowing which ones it doesn't pick up. What does a negative benzo screen mean in somebody that's, you know, that you think may actually have overdosed?
If cocaine is there, cocaine is there.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
Take it to the bank.
Yeah, my concern with urine drug screens is when they're ordered, you know, just as a screening test for no real reason. I used to do a lot of shifts in the pediatric emergency department at night, and some of the agencies like to bring their kids in for medical screening anytime they run away from home. I see no utility in that, and so I would frequently dig my heels in and refuse to order them, and go toe-to-toe with a few people, but
sometimes you just need to pick a fight.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, I don't think, you know, they'll come in asking for them without a bona fide reason.
And just if I could go back to the talking about getting levels, I think, you know, just blanket ordering all everything you can order, I don't think that's very beneficial. But certainly if the level would explain, you know, how they're presenting, then I think it's worthwhile. You know, if you don't know, but it's consistent with, you know, that kind of poisoning, then I think it's worthwhile to just check it. And often those, the levels we can get are on drugs that we could do something about or would have some kind of treatment for.
So. Now, what about the comprehensive urine? That's not something that's going to come back in our lifetime in our nine-hour shift in the ED. When are those beneficial to you guys when you see the patients later on in their hospitalization? Just ICU patients, patients that are undifferentiated and go to the floor? I mean, when is it helpful to you versus just, man, I really want to know? Because sometimes you just really want to know. That guy was weird.
Yeah, certainly we really want to know, and certainly there are cases where it's remaining a mystery. And in those cases, I think it is worth getting. Something to keep in mind when you do order a comprehensive urine drug screen is we do want it from the earliest urine sample we can get, and you need 30 cc's of urine. Also, there'll be a comment section where, you know, the lab is going to want you to put what the patient's on, what they've been given, and what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And then keep in mind that not everything is found in a comprehensive urine drug screen, and sometimes we have to do more specific testing. For example, a sedative hypnotic screen, if we are specifically looking for rohypnol, GHB, or ketamine, we can get that. It'll take 2 or 3 weeks to come back. And there may be the occasional instance where we might be interested. Frankly, sometimes it comes down to more of a forensic problem than a medical care problem. Patient wants to know, family wants to know, law enforcement wants to know, mom wants to know, but it's not going to make a difference in the medical care. And then, you know, do you really want to order a test that's going to cost, you know, probably $1,000?
Time to pick a fight.
Yeah.
So it sounds like from your basics of getting started, an EKG is a quick and easy test. A blood gas with a lactate will give you an idea of acidemia, alkalemia. A metabolic panel, aspirin, acetaminophen, and maybe a Utox. Those are kind of good starters.
Sure.
Okay. So for our patient, she comes back and we get these things, and we get that the patient has a acidosis. She's got a pH of 7.19. She's got a PCO2 of 34 and a bicarb measured on her metabolic panel of 13. So she's got a metabolic acidosis. I feel like I'm going to screw this up in front of the tox people. I'm certain of it. So she's got an anion gap of 11. Lactate also measured is 1.3. So basically an acidosis that's not otherwise well explained. So something happened to this lady. Clearly something is going on, but I'm not sure what it is. And so, Judson, I'm sorry to keep invoking your name, but Judson and I are talking about this, and we're trying to decide. Her head CT is negative. Her chest x-ray looks okay. EKG shows a narrow complex tachycardia of like 105, nothing outlandish. And that's what her labs show. Utox isn't back yet. So we're trying to decide between three factors. Is this lady intoxicated from something? Is she having a neurologic issue where she's maybe seizing, maybe one of those weird partial status things that they tell you about in hindsight? Or is this purely a psych issue? Is this girl just manifesting some kind of conversion disorder, which I'm a big believer is the last diagnosis you make before the patient dies. I don't like that diagnosis in the ED. I've gotten really close a couple times and saying I am 99.9% sure it's conversion disorder, but not so much to put it on the chart. I'm still doing the full court press with this one. Any thoughts on how to differentiate what's going on, or maybe some experiences you've had with, is this tox, is this neuro, is this psych?
Serial exams help you out here. I don't necessarily, I wouldn't expect you to be able to make the diagnosis necessarily with one shot with the patient and one review of the labs. You might have to go back, take a look as additional information becomes available.
What about seizures versus non-seizures, like actual epileptic seizures versus non-epileptic seizures? Any of your tricks that you do to determine the pseudo seizures?
I don't have any great tricks.
I've seen people that have had non-epileptic seizures on the EEG. I've seen them take an OPA. I've seen them do fine with the nail bed pressure. I've seen all of these little tricks fail. I don't have any good tricks either, but I have seen, some of you may have seen the attendings that will walk up while the patient's passed out and lift the hand over the face and watch it miss the face. I've seen patients get wise to that and they smack themselves in the face.
Yeah. I've also had very atypical presentations of temporal lobe seizures in teenagers that just look off, slow to respond, but able to answer some questions, can't put my finger on it, and they get the EEG. And
yeah, if I have a strong suspicion for the pseudo seizure, as you said, I'm pretty free to open up the ammonium salts and give them a waft of that and see what happens.
That's mean, Dr. Hurst. So, yeah.
But definitive.
No waterboarding. You can't do that to the patients. So, yeah, the other things that I've seen, pressure on the nail bed, the sternal rub, all the other things like that, they're certainly not very sensitive, and after a while I feel like we're just, like, torturing the patient, because I'm certain this young girl had some idea of what was going on and was just looking at Judson and I like, why do you keep hurting me? And we just couldn't figure out what was going on, because we were trying to decide, if we intubate this patient, we paralyze her, our exam is gone, and is it, you know, is that actually the first best step to just, well, she's altered, we don't know why, let's intubate her. I'm glad we decided not to. But then we got to figure out, well, are you seizing? Do you need something else? She had gotten some midazolam from EMS and we were debating on putting on more. Thankfully, mom came back at this point and gave us her list of meds. And it was amitriptyline, topiramate, Ativan, and acetaminophen. The story we got later is that she had locked herself in the bathroom for reasons involving not getting a new car, and then was found this way later, somehow made it out to the street, like ran out of the house. So it's actually good that we got her. It's good that we kind of figured this out, but it was still one of those baffling ones. Who do I call? Do I admit you to neurology? Do I admit you to ICU? Do I call psychiatry and have them talk to you for an hour and a half? I usually find that calling psychiatry is one of the last things we do, because they need a completely medically cleared patient for obvious reasons. And if the patient can't talk to psychiatry, there's not a whole lot that they're going to be able to do. I have seen one psychiatrist talk somebody into walking who was unable to walk, which was pretty awesome. But otherwise, that's usually one of the last bits that I go. I usually call you guys first, and then I call neuro when it's so weird I can't put a finger on it, and ultimately we admit to medicine.
Yeah, toxin neuro often end up on the same cases. Some of the most interesting cases I've seen over the past couple of years we've certainly been on together. Well, with that medication list, there are, you know, certainly a couple of things to think about. Acetaminophen, we're going to pick up with kind of the usual screening labs that we get with people. Clearly an important one not to miss, leading cause of liver failure in the this age group. The topiramate, even therapeutic use could potentially explain her non-GAP metabolic acidosis. It is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor, so it causes a proximal renal tubular acidosis, so that might explain the non-GAP acidosis, at least partially. And then her tricyclic antidepressant, and there are kind of seven things that I use as a mental checklist, and when I take care of folks that either got into a tricyclic or potentially got into a tricyclic. It causes reuptake inhibition of biogenic amines. It's thought to be the therapeutic action. So take that one off the list. And then there's the cardiac effects. Okay, you can get sodium channel blockade, manifest as QRS prolongation. Potassium efflux blockade, manifest as QT prolongation. So get an EKG. Take a look there. It can cause anticholinergic delirium as well as peripheral anticholinergic effects that might be a cause of her mental status change. But also, in addition, could cause urinary retention, dry mouth, dry axilla. Antihistamine effect, sedation, peripheral alpha antagonism, so hypotension, but specifically orthostatic hypotension. And we can get into that when it comes to medically clearing. You definitely want to walk patients because they can otherwise look okay, but then you stand them up and walk them, they syncopize because their blood pressure's down. And what am I missing? I'm missing one, right?
Yeah.
Alpha.
GABA channel.
Yeah, GABA antagonism.
At the peak rituxan site.
Yeah. So seizures. So, you know, was it the tricyclic? I'm less familiar with the topiramate overdose, but, you know, that could explain some of the lab abnormalities, certainly.
So, all in all, an interesting case. Definitely one I don't want to have on every shift. It's nice to kind of sit there and think for a while and actually use my brain and try to remember some of the stuff instead of just reacting out of a series of, flow diagrams like I feel like I can do sometimes. Yes, bronchiolitis. No, not bronchiolitis. But, yeah, kind of an interesting case. And I'll tell you, it's always good to call poison control to get a heads up from them on kind of what else we could be thinking because so much of this stuff, I mean, we just don't see all the time. When we have an overdose like this, it's nice to get the help. So, cool. Any other shout-outs from the Poison Center that you'd like our residents and nurses and medics to be doing?
Call us. Watch out for snakes.
Or don't.
Or don't watch out for snakes, yeah. Yeah, we've had a pool going the past several weeks. Everyone's putting a dollar down for the, we have a calendar, and for every date you pick, you have to put a dollar in an envelope, and then whoever gets the whoever picks the date of the first rattlesnake bite gets to keep all the money.
Does it count if I go to the Tucson Desert Museum and I actually put my hand in a cage? Because if so,
we give
I'm
that
in.
To you. If you're willing to do that, we give that to you. We give it to you.
A little crow fab will never hurt you, right? All right. Thank you guys very much.
Now, in fairness, topiramate toxicity is not really a deadly one per se, but I still like using my Million Ways to Die soundbite. So you give supportive care, you let the patients metabolize and excrete it off, but the important part from this I want you to take away is to not miss the other possibilities and to have a good approach to the strange patient. I think that getting tox involved early is good, but they also want to know what the exam was and they want to know some of the basic labs that we covered. Getting neurology involved to make sure that this isn't something else medical going on is useful because if the patient's in partial status, they're losing brain cells by the minute. And once everything else is cleared, once everybody else has kind of written them off, I think that you can start to say, well, maybe this is psychiatric. So much thanks and much love to our toxicology crew who came and helped us out. Please call tox, call often, and keep in mind that even for the little things that they just are going to document, they use this stuff for epidemiologic data, and you want to help them keep the lights on and the poison sensors so that when you do have someone that's crazy like this one, that you can call them and they'll be able to help you out. So thank you all very much. Seeing this crazy weird patient, how do you want to describe them? How do you want to put this down on the chart to justify that it wasn't a seizure or to justify that it wasn't psych? Several months ago, back in September. Oh, it's terrible. Back in September, Judson emailed asking if we could cover the necessary components of a neuro exam. Man, this is like the Judson podcast this month. Anyway, I sat down with Al Fiorello to talk about documentation for your neuro exam. This is something that Al kind of has a pet peeve about. This is also something he's really good at. Al does a lot of stuff with risk management. He's one of the better billers in our department. So, yeah, he knows his stuff. Advance for some of this static that you're going to hear. I think it's from a faulty cord, but we'll get it fixed and hopefully it doesn't deter you from getting some good info from Al's talk.
We're going to get back to some of the documentation stuff that we had talked about in the past. We haven't done documentation in a while, mostly because during the winter it's a point of contention where every patient feels like another chart. But we wanted to kind of give you a little extra push on documentation of what can actually be beneficial to you for all the different components. I've covered this before. I usually pound this into all of my acting interns that your chart is a historical document. It's a communication between providers, it's a billing document, and it's a legal document. So we have to satisfy all those things while also doing all the other stuff we got to do. So I was going to ask one of our charting masters, Al Fiorello, about how to document your neuro exam.
Hi, Kyle. How are you doing?
Good. So Al had some interesting stuff that he picked up about what our most common complaints are and why a good neuro exam might actually be important for us.
So there was a survey done by the government years ago, 2011, looking at ED visits, and they looked at the top six complaints coming to the ED, and those are abdominal pain, chest pain, fever, headache, cough, and back symptoms. And as you can see in those, there can be a neurologic cause for a lot of those things that we see. So definitely headache, back symptoms, fever when you're thinking about epidural abscess or meningitis. Even chest pain, abdominal pain, aortic dissection can have neurologic complaints or neurologic findings. So a lot of what we see, the neurologic exam is an important thing to document. And one of my biggest pet peeves when I go to sign off on a chart is a primary neurologic complaint like headache with an exceedingly lacking neurologic exam.
I think one of the favorite ones I've seen was ANO times 3 and a code arrest. It was, altered and obtunded times 3.
The templated charting is definitely a risk. So some people have a normal template and they just import that in and then they don't modify it appropriately. So that code cannot be alert and oriented times 3. The intubated patient can't have a GCS of 15.
Yeah, it's those little things like even the cardiac exam of regular rate and rhythm. Well, no, their heart rate was 150, so it wasn't regular rate.
And then your EKG shows AFib.
Yeah. These are frustrating things because you're like, well, you know what I mean. Well, I do because I'm here seeing the patient with you. But if somebody reviews the chart later, if Medicare looks at it and sees, oh, there's all kinds of charting errors, it basically just cuts you off at the knees for the entire chart. They can't trust you for anything. They go, well, how do I know all of this wasn't some kind of a dot phrase? So I'd like to preface this by saying that you all do an excellent job with charting. You do a great job. We appreciate all of the work that you do. And this is to give you a few extra tips so that when you go out and actually do this in the real world, you won't be spending forever in residency, no matter how much it feels like that right now. When you go out into the real world, this is going to help you to protect yourself, to take better care of your patients, and to get paid for what you do. So Al, let's start with the patient that does not have a neurologic complaint. So you have a 30-year-old female that comes in for complaint of fever, cough, and difficulty breathing. She's got focal crackles on her lung exam, and she's got a saturation of 91%. I'm thinking this lady probably has a pneumonia. So for her neuro exam, she doesn't have any neuro symptoms. Do I need to check her corneal reflex? Do I need to check her anal wink? I mean, some of these things that, you know, for a full neuro exam, you would consider. What do you think is important to chart for these patients?
So if you're checking her anal wink, make sure you have a good attorney, because I think you might get a little checking that in this patient. You know, like you said, there's multiple reasons for having a chart. And one of those reasons is billing. So if this pneumonia patient's going to be admitted, you really have to have a comprehensive physical there. So do you have to do an in-depth neurologic exam in this patient? Absolutely not. So you did mention fever, though, and fever can, neurologic emergencies can present as fever. So when I have a febrile patient in my neurologic exam, a lot of times I'll document no meningeal signs. But I don't think you need to be documenting a more in-depth neuro exam other than maybe no gross motor deficits. That's probably all you really did. You need to document what you did. Never embellish your chart and document things that you didn't do. So if you're saying that cranial nerves 2 through 12 are intact and you didn't check them, don't document that. In the patient that you think has pneumonia, you saw her move around the bed. You saw her kind of move all of her extremities. She has a grossly intact motor exam, but you're not checking different levels. You're not checking sensory exam. So just do what you document what you did and only do what you really necessarily need to do.
Usually what I'll do ANO, I'll say that they were alert, they were oriented. And even those questions, I don't ask them, ma'am, do you know where you are? Ma'am, do you know who you are? Do you know what year it is? You kind of go, well, they signed the paperwork that registration gave them. They put the correct date, which I can't do half the time. I think that they're okay. They're not obtunded. And then I'll usually do strength, and that's about it. I'll do that for kids as well, that the kids are moving all four extremities. Well, that's a good neuro exam. Basically, that they're alert, they're appropriate, and they're symmetric.
Sure.
So what about for the patient that comes in with a headache? Now we've got a neuro complaint that could be anything from I didn't drink my coffee this morning to I've got a subarachnoid hemorrhage. What does your headache exam look like?
Well, let me first start off by saying that some people say that with a primary neurologic complaint, you should do a complete neurologic exam. We do very little complete anything in the emergency department. Almost everything we do is focused. So what is a complete neurologic exam? You'll get a different answer from different people. You know, are you getting a tuning fork out and testing their hearing with a tuning fork? No, you're not. So you should do a focused neurologic exam related to the complaint they come in with. Now, headache. What are you worried about with headache in a neurologic exam? You're worried about mass lesions. You're worried about motor and sensory deficits. You're worried about overall global function. You're worried about potential for increased intracranial pressure. So not part of the neuro exam per se, but part of the neuro exam in my mind is looking at the fundus in these patients, making sure they don't have papilledema. So in the headache patient, I think you should document lack of meningeal signs. You should document kind of their overall neurologic exam. And then you should do a pretty focused motor exam from head to toe. Make sure they don't have cranial nerve deficits. Make sure that they don't have motor deficits. A gross sensory exam too. So my headache exam in the eye portion, I'll put a fundus exam. And kind of important to try and look at their fundus before you give them any narcotics, because trying to look at their fundus with tiny pinpoint pupils is near impossible. And then I document meningeal signs, and I document cranial nerves, and then a motor exam, sensory exam, cerebellar function. I think that all neurologic complaints, getting somebody up and walking is something that we do too infrequently. Getting somebody up and walking really tests a lot of things. It tests their strength, tests their proprioception, it tests their cerebellar function. A lot of times patients are all hooked up in the ED and it's hard to get them up and walking, but that sometimes will pull things out that weren't quite as obvious with them laying in the bed.
Can I just say that when Al asked me, what do you look for in a headache, I had this flash to residency and I almost answered you because I was felt nervous there for a bit. So, yeah, I usually have my spiel. When we used to dictate, I would have my standard thing I would say. And I'll say that in the ED, we do focused histories, focused physicals, and it's okay to have your standard approach that you do. Now, you need to know when to veer off from it and say, I need to do a bit more. I would have my standard alert and oriented times 3, cranial nerves 2 through 12 grossly intact, which you can really check in about 10 seconds if you get the patient to be cooperative. 5 for 5 strength, sensation grossly intact, 2 plus deep tendon reflexes, normal gait. And that's covers the majority of what I found to be important. I was talking with one of the residents about vision, and he or she had said, the patient had blurry vision, so we need to do a bunch of eye stuff. I said, I can say pretty assuredly that in 7 years of doing emergency medicine, I have never picked up anything based on blurry vision. Everybody has blurry vision for lots of different things. Now, loss of vision, double vision, those are kind of high-yield focused things. So much like when you're doing your NIH scoring, you can do every bit down to the wire, which can make a difference, or you can look for the high-yield stuff first. Oh, yeah, they've got a facial droop. They're not moving their right side against gravity, leg or arm, and they've got aphasia. There you go. That's a high-yield stroke. You can call that one, you know, within a range. So we start with kind of our high-yield points, and then we can fine-tune it if we find something's not quite right.
You mentioned alert and oriented times three. That's something that I wonder a little bit about sometimes, because sometimes people use alert and oriented times three as an intact orientation exam. Others, alert and oriented times four. So if you put alert and oriented times three, does that mean you're missing one, or is three your three? So sometimes it's a little better to say alert and oriented to person, place, and time. No matter how you do it, you should come up with kind of what is your usual and customary exam. So come up with what you think is your usual and customary comprehensive neurologic exam for your ED patient, and do that same thing and document the same way every time. That way, if it's ever called back later and you have to explain to yourself, my alert and oriented times three is to person, place, and time. And that's completely oriented in my book every time when I do that and document it.
Frank Walter has his 12 points that he goes through, which are great, but I can't remember them all. Sorry, Frank. I remember a lot of other stuff he taught me. There should be. If there isn't, there should be. So you can ask him what his 12 points are, and that'll give you at least a jumping off point, because he's very thorough in his evaluation, so he's not going to miss anything.
Another kind of pitfall, you mentioned cranial nerves, another charting pitfall is, you know, the templated, or even just blurting it out, cranial nerves 2 through 12 intact, a blind patient, a deaf patient, that's not ever true. So, you know, be careful just templating or rote responses in patients who have deficits.
When we used to dictate, I would find myself doing that all the time. You get into that kind of rote thing that you say, and then you go back, you go, oh, wait, no, he wasn't moving all four extremities. He was moving all three extremities. Forgot about that. So let's talk about another patient. Let's talk about your quote-unquote weird neuro patient. They come in with a very strange complaint that could be neurologic, it could be psychologic, it could be toxicologic, who knows what it's going to be. But they come in and they say, doc, I have this strange pain, I have this headache, and it goes down my neck and then kind of goes across my shoulders, jumps over my elbow, and starts to tingle into my middle finger, but no other fingers. But what do you think that is? I mean, we get these patients that have very strange complaints that the very first thing I want to tell them is, I have no idea, and I'm not going to figure it out. Do you want to stay for the rest of the show, or would you like to go home now? What do you do about neuro complaints in these patients, especially numbness?
I think those are tough. You know, the patient who's not moving an arm, the amount of things that can be is fairly limited. So, you know, the patient that just comes in with these weird, almost non-anatomical complaints, MS might be what they have. I think those patients, it's even more important to kind of do a more comprehensive neurologic exam to make sure there aren't subtle deficits that you might be able to pick up and might say, hey, I think this guy needs a workup in the ED, versus, you know what, you need to see your PCP and let them work this up as an outpatient. When you do a little bit more of a comprehensive exam and you're finding true deficits, those are the patients I'm like, you know, I think I need to work this patient up in the ED.
Yeah, there are some times where you pull out the needle and you go, look, I'm sorry, you came in with what could be a severe complaint, and I got to prove it. And I've seen patients that have some pretty good psychosomatic issues, and they can completely withstand it, even to the point of drawing blood. But you got to be more careful with those versus the patient that you go, yeah, it's strange, it's really numb right here. Right here, and as you poke them with the needle, they go, ow, yes, right there. Okay, not numb. It makes me feel a whole lot better. This is more of a paresthesia than a true sensory deficit.
Sure.
All right, the last group of patients we'll talk about, your obtunded patients. So this is a unconscious, unresponsive coming into room 14. As this patient comes in and you're kind of assessing them, what do you kind of grade your obtunded, somnolent, unresponsive, you know, how do you frame these patients? And then what do you do for their neuro exam when they're not able to cooperate
sure.
with you?
So some people will say Glasgow Coma Score should only be used in trauma patients. That was what it was designed for. That's what it has some predictive value for. But I think it is useful in non-trauma patients to put a Glasgow on the chart, because we all know what a Glasgow of 3 looks like. We all know what a Glasgow of 8 looks like. We all know what a Glasgow of 15 looks like. So in those patients, sometimes just putting that, you know, assessing that and putting it down gives the person looking at that chart a real quick idea of how potentially obtunded this patient is. You know, certainly the your ABCs come first, so you get a patient that comes in obtunded. Do they have an intact gag reflex? That's important to assess from a neuro standpoint, because if they don't, they may need airway intervention. Whether or not they're responsive to painful stimuli, whether or not they localize pain, moving all extremities or not moving all extremities is important too. So you may have an obtunded patient come in that's not moving their left arm or left leg at all. That's an important thing to kind of ferret out. You're going to be getting a head CT on that patient pretty quickly anyway, but that's one of the things to quickly assess. Are they moving all extremities? Do they have painful response to all extremities?
I think reflexes or looking for clonus can help you look for differentiate a toxicologic reason as well. We had this, you mentioned airway. We had this patient who was just a professional malingerer. She was fantastic. And she came in, would let you just examine her up and down, didn't care, didn't respond, wouldn't do anything. And then you put the tongue blade in, and I kind of went a bit too far, you know, on purpose. And man, did she come to life and was swinging. So your gag reflex is incredibly strong. So it's one of the last brainstem reflexes that you'll have. So if they've lost gag, you should definitely be concerned. How do you assess for gag reflex in your patients?
It sometimes ends up on your shirt, so that may not be the best idea. A lot of times what I'll do is I'll take a little saline and squirt it up their nose. And if they swallow, then you feel that their gag has got to be intact because they felt something in the back of their throat swallowed. If they don't do anything, and then a few seconds later they just start coughing uncontrollably because they aspirated what you just shot down their throat, they don't have an intact gag. I guess the other thing with obtunded patients too is floppy versus non-floppy. I remember back a case of meningitis that I saw that came in very obtunded, and you could lift this patient off the bed by picking their head up. Also can be, like you said, clonus or rigidity can be a clue into maybe this is a tox cause of their altered mental status.
That's good, because we sure don't see a whole lot of meningitis anymore.
Yeah.
It's something that's kind of a rarity, of where if you see one, everybody gown and glove, because you all need to see this, because you may not see this again for 10 years.
Sometimes. I just want to also mention one thing about motor exam. Sometimes I'll have residents present to me that the patient is kind of weak in their right grip. They're like a 3 out of 5 strength. If you're going to document a grading system, know what that grading system is. 3 out of 5 is pretty damn weak. That's not just a little subtle weakness of your grip. So just as a kind of a reminder, 0 out of 5 is complete paralysis. 1 out of 5 is you get a little flicker, a little bit of muscle movement, but no real great movement. 2 out of 5, they're unable to overcome gravity, but can move in the plane. So they're able to kind of move their hand across the bed, but they can't lift it off the bed. 3 out of 5, overcome gravity, but not against resistance. 4 out of 5, against resistance. And 5 out of 5, full strength. So someone that's got a little bit of a weak grip doesn't have a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, it's not just an estimate. It's actually, they actually have a scoring for this. And when you call neurology and you say that, it's going to, it may come back to bite you. When they come down and see the patient, they go, that's not 2 out of 5. So it's nice to know some of these scorings.
One other thing, I think it might have been Greg Henry that I heard this from at one point. Greg Henry, as I think a lot of you know, is a legend in emergency medicine, and neuro has kind of been one of his fortes over the years. And he talked about a 3-part cross the midline test to test if someone's safe to go home. And it's close your eyes, take your right thumb, touch your left ear, and stick your tongue out. And it kind of sounds silly, but that's actually testing a lot of different things. It's testing their hearing, their ocular spatial orientation, knowing their right from left, which digit to use, crossing midline, and combine that with a normal gait, your patient's probably okay to go home from a neuro standpoint.
That is sweet. I'm totally going to do that. Say that one more time with the test.
Close your eyes, take your right thumb, touch your left ear, and stick out your tongue, and then get up and walk.
Out the door. I am totally going to do that. I may choose middle finger, though, depending on the patient. Good. So again, these are a couple tips on what to do for your neuro exam. Figure out what's going to work best for you, figure out a flow, and apply that to each patient, fine-tuning it as you need to.
One last closing thing about documentation and just some precautions. Don't document what you didn't do. Be careful with your templates. And for primary neurologic complaints, make sure you do a fairly comprehensive ED neurologic exam and document it.
It's getting later in the year right now, and so we decided to ask Peter Rosen some questions related to residency training and the transition as you go out into the real world. One of the things I wanted to ask him about was procedural competency. I've often heard senior residents say, you know, I've never done a peds intubation before, or I've never done a pericardiocentesis, I've never done a cricothyrotomy. Do I actually need to do every procedure before I graduate, or can I just know the steps in the indications and feel fine? Personally, I've struggled with this as well because there are several procedures I've never done that probably some of you guys have done. So let's ask the man that wrote the book.
Well, we're talking about several different kinds of procedures. I think for a resident to leave who's never done an intubation, there's something wrong with his residency. And there's something wrong with the resident.
I think it was pediatric specifically.
Yeah, but you can still obtain that experience if it means on your day off going to the OR and intubating children. You can obtain that experience. And the fact that you haven't done it, I think, is some evidence that you've been a little lazier than you should have been. Cricothyrotomy is a hard procedure to get experience in. And yes, you can practice it on a cadaver. You can maybe practice it on a dog. It doesn't work well on a pig. It's a very hard procedure to get experience with. Now, the chances are you're not going to see one in your private practice. But if you do have a patient who needs it, and you've at least tried one in your residency in the simulated fashion the best you can, then you have to decide, is this an indication for one? Because if I don't do it, this patient's going to die, and some care is better than no care. Or do you have an alternative, which might not be the first choice of alternative, but it will give you control of the airway? Is there something else you can do short of a surgical airway that maybe you would prefer not to do, but you have to in this situation? And then finally, you have to say, there are procedures that I've never done, I've never seen, I don't know how to do, and therefore, even though the patient might survive with it, I'm not going to try it. I don't feel comfortable, because I don't have the first clue on how to do it, such as perhaps a C-section in a dying mother or burr holes in a patient who appears to be herniating from an epidural. Nobody's going to hold you at fault for not trying something you don't know how to do. Nobody will hold you at fault for trying it either. But if you have a bad outcome, you will be sued, and you will have to answer why you are doing something you've never done before. But that wouldn't stop me from trying. What would stop me from trying is a feeling of inadequacy that I can't do this procedure, certain operations that I've never done that I wouldn't tackle, even though I used to be a surgeon. I just wouldn't know how to start.
Well, it seems that without Jared here, I'm not really up for picking a fight, Brian. This was all kind of common sense, just do your job, down and dirty emergency medicine. Just right up your alley, right? So hopefully you can weigh in on some of your opinions. We'll get our peer review, and we'll wrap this bad boy up. What do you say, Brian?
Hi, everybody. It's Brian here for the peer review of April 2015. I agree with you, Aaron. I think this is an easy transition this month, and I really don't have a lot to say, but let me give you my quick takeaway points on what you guys talked about. We started out today with an 18-year-old who was protruding her tongue and swinging her right hand, and the first thing I was thinking of is drop a bass for this lady. Let the beats go. Just let her freak flag fly. I mean, give her some music. Don't just let her dance there in a sterile ED environment. For these patients that are altered, and maybe it's tox or neuro or psych or some component, I like to do my quick things first and then get them off and scan their head. So the quick things I can get back that they were talking about today were I get a D-stick, I get my venous gas sent, and I get an EKG. I strip the patient down completely, take a look at them, put them in a warm gown and sheet, and then get them off to the scanner as fast as I can, because I really just want to take out big bleed in the head, big neuro tumor that I have to worry about. I want to take those big things out of the way, take the easy things, make them quick and easy, and then your other labs you'll order while the person's in the scanner, and you'll come back, know whether or not there's a bleed or not, and then you go on, and then you start to figure out what else could be going on. I think Stuart's Squadron does a really good job, if you've ever heard of any of his altered mental status approaches, and he breaks it down very simply and covers some of the key points of emergency medicine that we need to know on any of these altered patients. I agree with the labs that Rob and Nick were talking about. I think, you know, CK, basic chemistry, and then adding things on that you think fits the patient's profile. If they're young, probably not digoxin. If they're older, maybe digoxin. So you would add tests and how their toxidrome appears, any medical history you get, whether like Aaron did the right thing, sending the mother home, pulling all those medicines and bringing them back in. So do your lab test based on what you think the patient has, based on their presentation or information you're getting from EMS or family members. Aaron brings up a good question. What do you do with these patients? Now you get some labs back, you've ruled out some big things, they're altered, they're acting funny, you're not sure what's going on. For these patients, I like to do a tincture of time. I get my initial labs, and I will send a 2-hour lab set, mainly chemistry, venous gas, make sure I recheck a sugar. Sometimes I'll even get a cereal, aspirin, or Tylenol if I'm worried that that may be complicating the picture. And at the 3-hour mark, I've had the patients for 3 hours. I've had 2 sets of labs hopefully come back. I've seen what they've done. And then I can decide, oh, they're waking up. Maybe I'll send them home. I'll watch them a few more hours. Or I decide this person isn't going anywhere fast and they need to come into the hospital. So that's kind of my general approach to these patients. But they are tricky. They're not straightforward. And you definitely want to go broader in these patients because so much is undifferentiated and they're not telling you much of what's going on. In terms of specific disposition, most of these patients I will end up putting in the ICU for, say, a 23-24 hour period, at least one overnight. And part of that is just to see what happens. It's hard to do the amount of nursing care and serial exams on a floor, even a step down unit, especially if they're not opening their eyes or not verbalizing. Those are more indications, in my mind, someone should be in the unit as opposed to the floor. Aaron was also bringing up, he didn't know if he should intubate or not intubate. I think he did a really good job in not intubating these patients. The key for me, and Al and Aaron were kind of talking about this in the neuro section, I think for patients who are altered, I don't always use the GCS as my intubating tool. The biggest key I look for is, can they handle secretions? So not even as much a gag reflex, because maybe you run into the sword swallower or somebody who doesn't have a gag reflex, but are they handling secretions? I like the squirting of liquids down the nose and seeing what happens. Are they choking on it, coughing? So I think that is a key for me. Can you handle secretions? Are they maintaining their oxygenation status? Are they not getting hypercarbic? If I can say all those are going well, I probably won't intubate them and I want to see how they do. And maybe it's I wait 1 minute to intubate them. Then I wait 5 minutes. Then I wait 15 minutes. I wait half hour. Now I've waited an hour. They're still doing fine. So I'm starting to get more of a stability feeling that I can keep waiting on this person as I'm reassessing them and they are doing okay. So I think Aaron did a nice job in not intubating, allowing the person to try to wake up or clear or determine what way they were going to go. That's all I have for the altered mental component. For the neurologic component that Al and Aaron were talking about, what kind of an exam and does it vary per patient? I agree. I think it does vary per patient. Patients with specific neurologic complaints, I do a more focused neurologic exam than I have done on other patients who are coming in with belly pain or sore throat. The keys that I try to put in my chart and I try to stress to people, I think were hit on by Aaron and Al very nicely. Speech and gait. I always comment on speech and gait on just about every patient. I try to say speech and gait are within normal limits. That simple line always reminds me, oh, I've got to walk the patient, and oh, I've talked to them and they've conversed with me, and yeah, they are doing pretty well. And like Al was saying, there are so many components to gait. When you're talking proprioception, balance, you're talking about motor tone, sensory, the inputs you need from the visual stimulus to be able to walk in a straight line. All those are important components that speech and gait by themselves are probably most of your neurologic exam. The other way you can say, yeah, they're hooked up to things, I don't necessarily want to walk them. And we always want urines on these patients, so walking the patient to the bathroom with a urine cup, asking for their urine, is a great way to get the urine and assess their gait. Other things I add for my headache neurologic exam is I definitely palpate the head all over looking for trigger points, and I also palpate the temporal artery. Those are not necessarily in the neurologic component, but just as headache exam pointers. I will ask patients for my exam when talking about blurred vision versus double vision. I'll ask them to read a clock or read their iPhone, read a name on the wall. If they see two of that name, that is a whole lot different, like Aaron said, as opposed to, it's just not as clear, but they're able to read it fine. As long as they're reading, that's another good sign. If you have a patient with a neurologic complaint, make sure you do a full neurologic exam, cerebellar, cranial nerve, sensory, motor, speech, gait, vision. All these are important parts to comment on. I agree, you're not going to have a tuning fork. You may not be doing your Rinn and Weber sign, but get all of those in the neurologic component and be accurate in what you do. I agree, document what you did, don't document what you didn't do. Last was Peter and Aaron talked briefly about procedures and whether you would do them and if you haven't done them. And I think for all of us, there's probably procedures we have rarely done or can count on one hand, or procedures that we have never done. For me, I've never had to place a pediatric central line.
Man, you are one pathetic loser.
If I was in the position where I felt I had to, I probably would. I may try for alternatives first, but I would do it using probably a similar technique as I do in adults. Other procedures that Peter commented on with Crike and emergency baby delivery for perimortem C-section or a thoracotomy, those probably, you're right, you won't have done in residency. From my own experience, I'll tell you, I did no Crikes in my residency. I did one thoracotomy with a trauma attending, and I did have done no perimortem C-sections ever. My third shift out, I had to do a thoracotomy by myself. I did a Crike within my first year being out, and I've only done two Crikes in my entire career, and I've done two thoracotomies in my entire career. So they are rare. I do think sim and cadaver are huge in terms of getting you to walk the motions. So if you can visualize those procedures and you can go through the hand motions and you've done it before and created a little bit of muscle memory, you refresh yourself on it, you hear people talk about it, I think you can go through a lot of the core emergency medicine procedures. And I agree, if you feel absolutely no confidence in it, probably shouldn't be doing it. And you're going to have to balance patient's need, your comfort in the procedure, distance to definitive care, as well as how serious the condition the patient is in. So we would have patients, say, in Guam, where if I want to fly them off the island, the closest place is 4.5 hours by fixed wing. We did a lot more procedures and things over there because we knew we couldn't transport to a place. So if you're in a rural location, maybe a little different. Maybe there's no one you can transfer to, so you're stuck. You're like, well, not going to do it because even if I transfer them, they won't make it through that transfer. So I think become comfortable in as many procedures as you can. And if you haven't done them before, read about them. Walk it through. And if you're ever in a place where you do feel uncomfortable with it, you're not wrong for opening up a textbook or a web page and reading about the procedure before you have to do it. You may do this on just an ulnar nerve block you haven't done in a while. but that's okay. You can phone a friend. Ask your OBGYN colleague that's 200 miles away maybe how to help deliver the baby. Can you be on the phone with me while I'm delivering this baby? Nothing wrong with that. Well, thanks so much, guys. And Aaron, I agree with you. I think having Jared out of the mix, there was much less anger and intensity, and the discord was just absent. I liked it. Oh, Jared, we missed those locks, though. See you guys later. See you next month. Bye.